This is African Port, and my name is Philip Nyakbo. Paul Victor Obing, or simply PV Obing, occupied a powerful position as chairman of the Committee of Secretaries under Jerry Rawlings' PNDC military government, which ruled Ghana from 1982 to 1992. He was the de facto prime minister for Rawlings. When the PNDC switched from a military regime to a political party named the National Democratic Congress and won elections, Mr. Obing served as presidential advisor on governmental affairs from 1992 to 1997. After a brief retirement from politics, PV Obing was appointed by the new president, John Kufuor, as chairman of the Ghana Investment Promotion Council. Next, he went on to work for President John Atta Mills. In 2013, he was appointed, this time by President John Mahama, as a senior presidential advisor at the presidency. All told, PV Obing worked for four different presidents. PV Obing was known as an orator, and a joke was that he stood a good chance of convincing Queen Elizabeth to give up her throne. In spite of this, he almost never granted interviews, but I convinced him to speak to me on a wide range of topics sometime in March 2002. Sadly, PV Obing died in 2014, but his voice is preserved in this interview, which I am now making available on African Pod in audio. At the beginning of the interview, I looked into PV Obing's sharp eyes and asked him to tell me who he is.
PV Obing is a simple Ghanaian. He studied to be an engineer. He's worked as an engineer. He's been invited to serve in government, has served in government, and has gone back to live a normal private life in a small town near Accra, Tema.
Where did you grow up?
My hometown, Accra Kerry, near Obuasi, and then in Accra.
What was your childhood like?
I think that I had a very challenging childhood, and that has taught me to know how to face challenges of life, and I guess that is what I'm all about.
What are some of those challenges that you recall?
Well, I left my parents at a very early age, five years, and stayed with my uncle, and that taught me a lot. I didn't live with a poor home. I didn't live in a poor home. I didn't live with a poor family, but I guess it was destined that I should be made to live a full life that would make me mature. I didn't have many privileges as a child. I lived a hard life. I worked for everything that I had, and I guess that taught me to know how to demand merit out of effort rather than to have merit out of nothing.
So your childhood, when you were growing up, what dreams did you have? Did you think you would become the PV Obing you are now, or you were before and you are now?
I guess I didn't sleep enough, and therefore I didn't have time to dream enough. Therefore, I would not even say that I dreamt to be what I am. But as a person, let me say that I have played it by the ear. I have looked at opportunities, I've looked at situations, and I've always try to play my best role to get the best out of his situation. And if that is if I have been anything good, it's because my endurance and my perseverance have worked in my favor.
So those years when you were awake and not sleeping, what are some of the things you thought about for yourself?
I always wanted to learn hard and get a profession and do things that I was not able to do when I was a child, like it is every child's dream. I wanted, first of all, to be like my uncle that I lived with. He had a very big store of values. Never reap where you have not sown. Don't expect to have a crown without bearing a cross. Don't look for privileges from people. Achievement is through effort and not through privileges. And these were some of the values that I still hold close to me, my chest. Apart from everything that my uncle helped me to become, the one that I cherished most was to make me feel that you have to work for whatever you have. And he it went so well, it worked so well for me, that even when he died and he decided to bequeath everything he had to me, I decided to bequeath everything back to his wife and children, because I thought that the values he had taught me were more valuable than all the riches or all the assets that he was bequeathing to me. And I always dream that I took the right decision then, because I cherish his memory and I cherish the value that he's imparted onto me.
You are an engineer and an orator. It's hard to combine both. Tell me, what informed your decision to go and study engineering in the university and not an arts course?
Well, I know I'm an engineer. As an orator, I am not sure. I don't know if I am. But let me say that as part of the strict training that my uncle gave me, I was made to spend a lot of time during the vacations working in a mechanic shop next door to our house in Kokomimili. So that before I was an O-level graduate, before I became an A-level graduate, I was already a mechanic by all measure. And therefore, I guess that prodded me on to go into engineering. Besides, at that time, the commonly known subjects that led anybody to engineering was physics, mathematics, pure maths, and applied maths. And those were subjects that were very close to my heart. So I guess that my own life beginnings, the training and the shepherding that my uncle provided me, and my appreciation for maths and physics allowed me to be shepherded eventually into the gateway to engineering. Because at that time, you know, situations were not such that people would get career counseling in school, and that external factors will influence the career that you choose. And perhaps I guess that either by accident or by design, the path of my youth landed me into engineering, and I've done the best out of it. Oratory, I don't know. I don't know how one measures it, and therefore I cannot claim to its fame.
What have you done in the world of engineering?
I've done quite a bit. Most engineers have done so, but the circumstances in which we find ourselves or we work don't enable what we do, modest as they are, to get beyond the environments in which we operate. But let me say that I started as a simple mechanical engineer with UAC company, now joined into Unilever. I was a workshop engineer working in the machine shop division of the company. And that in that operation, I was made to use machine tools to produce components which did not have immediate replacement equivalents. That helped me to deepen my creativity in engineering, so that it got to a stage eventually in life when I was an engineer at Mankwazi Fisheries Limited, growing through the ranks to become technical director, that I was able to manufacture in our foundry and machine shop many complicated components into machine elements on ships in coal stores, which we were not available in those days. If you look at the history of Ghana between 1972 up to about 1986, thereabout, with the shortage of foreign exchange, with import license system, with no stocks or spare parts in most shops, you had to use ingenuity like they do very often in local shops, location. And this is exactly some of the things that I used to do. And if I tell you that I was able to resurrect whole ships from very little imported components, if I tell you that I was able to create facility for irrigating a whole field in the field without much component, you would then see that, modest as they are, we made a little contribution. But most of these were grounded on using the creative intellect to generate something which you would not pick from any shelf.
Your ability in the world of oratory, some people believe that you can convince the Queen Elizabeth to give up her throne. I mean, when these things are said about you, how do you feel about it?
Well, if you are in real life and you are in politics, as I have been in both, you must have the inner capacity to shut your mind against these praises, because those are the things that will take you off your track. Hear them, acknowledge them, and give thanks to whoever gave you intellect, the Almighty. But don't allow that to get into your being. And let it be a stimulus for you to always strive for the best, rather than for you to rely on what you think is the best in you already.
Have you ever met a man, a woman, or a child that you've never been able to convince?
I don't make it my life pattern to go around trying to convince people. I meet people, we interact. If they get convinced, fair enough. If they don't, I agree to disagree with him, and she may have the same opportunity to disagree with me. I don't ever make it my point that whoever I meet must agree to my point of view before we depart. That is, I think, self-conceitedness of
but in a large school. Way, you are able to get your noble way.
Let's say so in most of the cases, but that is because the truth is allowed to defend itself, not because I force falsehood to turn into truth.
I am talking to Mr. P.V. Obeng, former government minister, now living a quiet life. Now, you were in Takoradi, right? And then you came to give a lecture as part of the Golden Jubilee of the anniversary lecture of the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology on the theme Evaluating the Impact of the Technocrat in National Development, the newest factor. Who is a technocrat?
Well, technocrat means two things to two different people. Technocrat, for the context, in the context of the UST factor, is a graduate of that university, just as you will call a graduate of Lagonite, whatever. Ex-students of UST, KNUST, are called technocrats. But I guess it's not a word that they chose out of nothing. They chose technocrat because many of them have gone through the university and have learned technological courses, making them technologists that make them technocrats. But for other people, a technocrat technically is somebody who trains and practices in technology and in technical skills. And this is what many people who do engineering, architecture, pharmacy, biochemistry, real estate do. So to many people, technocrat means somebody who has acquired technical skills and is living a profession in technical details, using hand and mind to create and to resolve problems. But for the purposes of the discussions today, we're using technocrats in the two different contexts, as addressing people from UST, ex-graduates of UST, and also addressing people who have studied technology and are living and practicing technology as their career.
So are you a technocrat?
I guess I am. I'm an engineer. And again, in the other context, I'm an ex-student of KUNSC. Therefore, I qualify to call myself a technocrat out of the generic reference to all students of that university.
Yes, so you are different. What makes you different?
I'm not different. I don't think I'm different.
You're different in the sense that as a technocrat, you've gone into a different world. I mean, a world that belongs to people in the arts, you know, generally. So you're different. What made you different? I mean, what made you such an outspoken technocrat?
By the way you have put this question, you are making yourself a beautiful example of the bad situation where people think that technically inclined people should not be able to convey thoughts, should not be able to articulate their dreams, and should not be able to project thinking, original thinking in development issue. But truly speaking, people are made, are led to choose professions on account of their innate qualities and characteristics. Most technocrats have certain characteristics which are equally good for other purposes. A technocrat must be able to search for the truth and apply the truth in an incontrovertible manner. He should be able to see a problem when it's arising and when it's arising. He should be able to develop a due process for attacking that problem and find a solution that will be resolute in the resolution of the problem. A technocrat must be a team player, as I said this afternoon, because most societal problems are of such a kind that you need teams to address them rather than individuals. So a good technocrat must be a team player. A good technocrat must be able to also assess the body of information available to him and be able to select those that are applicable for the solution of a particular problem. If all these things are put together, then any technocrat really must become a problem solver. And the mechanics of solving problems are, one, understanding the nature and the root cause of the problem, understanding what led to it, how to reverse the trends that brought the problem about, and how to maintain the status quo after you have resolved it, such that it does not recede back to where it came from. These are the body of skills and knowledge that you need for solving engineering problems, architectural problems, developmental problems, and management problems. And indeed, political office holding is an astute management function. And any person who is born in, who grows into a profession that enables them or enables him to use his intellect and his practical experience to resolve problems along the lines that I have postulated, will be a good politician, will be a good manager. But sometimes we think it's only when you have done social sciences, the exact sciences, that you are cut for that. That is not the case. And I think in that respect, we in this part of the world are behind.
Some of your technocrat folks feel that we have a system in our country in which politicians seems to suffocate, you know, the technocrats. Do you believe that? I mean, what's the dimension of that view?
Well, I guess in this sphere, we are all under the dead weight of some prejudices. First of all, historically, many of the politicians have been people from the humanities. And it has been so established that they then feel that that is their enclave. Again, historically, people in the technical sciences have felt that their function is in the laboratory, in the workshops, behind the drawing board, behind computers and so forth, and they will need direction from the policymakers, which they perceive to be those in management functions at the level who are the politicians, before they can activate their ingenuity. So, with all of us living in our prejudicial cages, we think that that is the normality that should be. But indeed, the real situation must be that the suffocation must not exist, because there should be a two-way communication between the policymaker and the implementer. And in the modern sense of problem solving, policymaking is not done without the influence and involvement of the policy implementer. It is because these two factions historically have been kept in mutually exclusive pigeonholes that one has thought that we have our functions cut for us and they are mutually exclusive. This is what feeds this so-called suffocation. Engineers, the technologists feel that they have no role in policy making and in politics, and therefore they should resolve themselves into taking orders and doing what they must do, while the others think policy making is their preserve. When the joint does not happen, then we call it frustration. And the policymakers feel frustrated that the implementers don't understand and appreciate their perception and are not able, therefore, to respond to them. The technocrats also feel that their inputs did not get into the policy in the first instance, and what has emerged as policy is insufficient as a source to respond to. And it is the frustration of us living in two mutually exclusive compartments that make us all suffer. So it's a two-way frustration, and I think that it needs an appropriate partnership between policymakers, technologists, and people of other professions coming together into the same melting pot and sharing the burden of analyzing and resolving problems.
That's a large question you're trying to answer, and I would have to ask it again. How do you free the system? How do you manage the system to make it efficient between the perceived policymakers and the implementers down, who are actually the technocrats?
Already, in the world of democracy, the concept of the government dealing with civil society is responding to that historical deficiency. Before, governments thought their job was to determine policy and to drive development initiative. Today, we are beginning to feel that you don't develop for the people. You must develop with the people. And that the people must be organized in civil societies to be able to respond. If you take this correspondence into the field of technical practice and professional practices, it means there must be a forum where policymakers interrelate, interact with technicians, technologists, with a view to addressing issues of common concern, for the politician or the policymaker to understand the perspectives of the technologists, for the technologists to understand and appreciate where the politician is coming from, and creating an environment where, with the commonality of purpose, we can attack the problem with the same zeal. This is being done. I'm sure that if you look at the kind of interdisciplinary efforts that are taking place at the National Development Planning Commission in the past and also in the present, if you look at the kind of fora that were created, what they call the National Economic Forum, where various people of various disciplines came together, you will see that the realization is coming that everybody has an input to make in developing policy. We only now have to look at what happened on this one-off situation and find ways of institutionalizing it so that that initiative can be sustained. I think that is the challenge that both the government and institutions, governizing professionals, will have to do to ensure that in the long run, an appropriate and enduring institution is created with due processes established for the communication between policymakers and policy implementers to be on an ongoing basis rather than on a one-off situation.
And on the heels of that concern, Mr. P.V. Obing, will be technology. I mean, the role technology plays in our system. What is happening here is that as far as technology is concerned in the world, Ghana and even Africa is seeming to be placing second or third, right? What's given rise to that? I mean, what's the reason for that, that it always has to find itself in the second position?
Well, technology is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. In the history of the world, wealth became the main cause that promoted development and promoted other values in the materialistic world. In those days when the wealth of a nation or the wealth of a person is measured by the physical assets he had, the natural resources a country had, we were okay. We had gold, we had diamond, we had bauxite. We thought we only needed means of extracting these to sell to get whatever we wanted. But something else came in the meantime. Those who did not have the natural resources that we had decided that they must take one step above us and create a body of knowledge and expertise that will add value to what we had to come back to us. And they have created technology that adds value to our natural raw materials, circulates it, transforms it into a usable value, and they sell it to us. And in the medium of exchange, transfer pricing is taking place. Technology took a higher stake in terms of value than the natural resource. And since that technological body was created outside ourselves as people who harbored or countries that harbored natural resources, they were way ahead of us. And I'm sure that the gap still remains because we have as yet not found an answer to how to jump the gap and also acquire the same technological skills. That now is the gap between the poor and the rich. It's no more the measure of how much resources we have as against what they do not have, but it's how much technology they have to put on what you have to turn into a product which you don't have. Example, we have bauxite. You have to turn bauxite into alumina, energy intensive, capital intensive. We have the bauxite, but what do we have at Barco? We have alumina and cryolite, turning it into aluminum ingots. So our bauxite has then little value. The alumina that comes back after adding value to our bauxite then gets a higher value, and we import it at a high foreign exchange. Then it immediately shows you that disparity in terms of derivatives from the efforts and activities is on the side of technology. And until such time that we are able to find an answer to the means of bridging that technological gap, we still have a nightmare in terms of balance of payment, balance of trade, and so forth.
So until we find the answer, what's keeping the answer away from us?
I think it's lack of consistent focus. We as a people, led by government and assisted by professionals within the country, must begin to work together to develop the right focus that can enable us focus on what it takes to capture the road to the technology that we now don't have. Because it is that when we get added to our natural resources will lift us up from where we are.
Does it mean that the successive governments of the past and perhaps the present have not had that focus?
Let me tell you something. I mean, in any firefighting situation, your first aim becomes how to kill the fire and not how to prevent fire from getting erupted. And I think we've been caught in this bind of firefighting our way through economic deprivation and underdevelopment. And if it is so, it's not because we have willed it to be so. The circumstances of the internal and external factors have railroaded us into that corner. And I think it takes everybody's input for us to realize where we are and to work towards getting ourselves out of there. The pressures on us to remain where we are huge. The pressures are large. We need to deny ourselves certain offerings. We need to deny ourselves certain quick fixes. We need to now focus on fundamental things which we think what everybody on the board will be able to discover to be able to reverse the trend.
But that trend was not the situation or the condition at the birth of the country.
At the birth of the country, our preoccupations were different.
What were they?
Seek ye first the political kingdom, and everything will be added onto it. Now we have found that political kingdom, but we have been diverting our attention away from the economic kingdom because of other imperatives that came our way. So we need to always retrace our track down and see where we move from there. There's no lack of consensus on what we want for Ghana and what we want for Ghanaians. But when it comes to finding ways of making what we want for Ghanaians happen, we all separate we go in our separate ways. It is when we develop the critical mass of cohesion and compactness in our approach and our attitudes that I believe we all will get to where we want to go. It's not an easy task. Others have done it. We can do it. But we need, as a people, to have confidence in ourselves. We need, as our people, to find the many things that join us as against the many things that divide us, for us to forge that unity of purpose for us to move forward with development and growth as our main objective.
Why has there been a point of departure for this critical unity that can get us results?
I think we are learning from too many people too fast, and we are not allowing the realities of our own situation to guide the path that we must tread. I guess that's the problem.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, we want to be a democratic country. Democracy is the way forward. But democracy for me is not an end. Democracy must be a means to an end. But we have now become adherents of utopian democracy to the extent that some real issues which will give props to democracy are being left behind. Because if you look into our constitution, the constitution grants many democratic rights to our people. Right to education, right to health, accommodation, right to well-being, employment. These are all democratic rights. But it does not take the constitution to deliver these rights to our people. It requires policy jointly owned by the people and commit and developing us into an action program jointly owned and adhered to by the people to take us from the dream to the reality. But I think that we are taking too much time discussing issues of utopian democracy and leaving the actions that we need to give the props that will support democracy out. People say that politics is concentrated economics. So that before we can clean up and maintain a sanctified political environment, our economics must also be sanctified and sustained. But I think we have more to do in achieving that. And until that is achieved, there will be no instability within the society and instability in government. Because no government wants the worst for his people. It is only when a government gets frustrated that his promises are not being fulfilled and that the people may be reacting against it, that they will find repressive ways of keeping the people's anger down, for instance. So that if we can find ways of supplying the requirements and the expectations of the people, it will release the burden on government, and governments will not have to be repressive. So the question is, how do we bail the cats? Do we put the cat before the horse or the horse before the cat? And I think these are some of the things that we as a people will continue to grow to admit and to do something about. Our democracy is after all very young. And maybe we are again seeking utopian democracy first, hoping that practical democracy will follow. We will learn through the process, and I'm sure Ghanaian experience will put us where we must be.
What's practical democracy for the Ghanaian that should be the boat that everyone should be putting their hands on now?
I think democracy, first of all, has its basic attributes. The right of association, the right of choice, the right of freedom, these must be granted. But they must be granted so that we can use this right of expression to give give free expressions of options for development, and hoping that the machinery that will save this free expression of options will be able to galvanize these opinions, analyze them, and get the best out of it for our common good, and be able to market it to us. Because sometimes the truth will be there, it will be admired, but until it's presented to you as the real truth, you may not see it as such. So there's a lot of bearing on us, on our political leaders, because we have started from a position of division already, and it requires a lot of effort for them to galvanize us into a common sense of purpose. And it will require a lot of effort, the contemplated reconciliation effort, if properly executed, could have been a way forward in allowing people to tone down their political prejudices and surrender their will to a common effort to push the Ghana forward. But as you can see, merely on issues of timing and whatever, already we are divided even as we want to reconcile. So the challenges are many, but I'm sure that as we go through one difficulty and go from problem to problem, we will be able to overcome.
So some people perceive political, social, and economic acrimony in the system. Briefly, how should will these be dealt with, you know, so that the cohesion that is required for development would come in place?
Who am I to pontificate on what Ghana can do in the future? What I can say is that it takes the small points of consensus to form the basis for bigger points of consensus. Let us find the minimum things over which we will agree and make that our national collective national agenda. As we work on those few points of agreement, we'll be able to resolve the conflicts which are intended, some of which are intended, some of which are unintended, away, and then build on the national, on the bigger lines of consensus. I am sure that with this, as we grow and we learn how much we need each other, we'll be able to get to the stage where the issues that will bind us will become demystified.
It's a long time you left government. What have you learned after leaving government for this time as a Ghanaian?
Well, I've learned a lot. I've learned how to be in government, how to be out of government. And I'm now in a position to advise people who are going to government on how to behave so that you can go in and come out unscathed. I've also learned how tolerance enables you to succeed in politics. I have learned how openness and objectivity will enable you to go to government and come out, even if you do things that will hurt a few people. If you hurt on matters of principle, you'll not be a victim. But if you hurt on selective application of retribution, then of course you'll be seen to have been personal in your attitude. But what I've also learned is how much those who go into politics and leave should be able to help those who go back into politics with institutional memory to enable them do things in ways that will push the country forward. And that's why, for instance, when I was invited by the government to continue to be the chairman of the Ghana Investment Promotion Center, contrary to my own personal desires, I opted to take the offer, because I think that it's a good way by which I can use the experience I accumulated by being a front runner in government to support national development from a backbench.
Age has not told much on you, right? You're still looking young and very energetic. Your future?
If God gives me well, I'll live on.
And do what? And be what?
And do the best that I can with the grace of He who gives me strength.
And the best includes what?
Doing something for myself, my family, and doing something for the society to which I belong.
and doing something for society, like what? If you can be specific.
Well, in my own way, I am sharing my thoughts. What I came here to do, for instance, is one such way of sharing the experience one gains by encountering government with others who have not had the opportunity, using my knowledge of the creative potential in private sector to create one or two enterprises that will give an opportunity for others to find employment and to help the national economy. And my own little way, assist any organization and body that chooses to make contact with me for interaction of opinions.
It's a pleasure having you around, Mr. Paul Victor Obeng. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
And that was PV Obeng. Mr. Obeng died in May 2014, 12 years after I interviewed him. Needless to say, I have vivid memories of the man who used to occupy powerful positions in government and worked for four different Ghanaian presidents. For more groundbreaking interviews, subscribe to African Pod on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or on your favorite podcast app. You can also find us on YouTube. Just search for African Pod and subscribe. Follow us on Twitter at African Pod. African Pod is everywhere on the internet and all for free.